Okay, so Thomas Meyer, we're in Sofia, thanks to you, to see the ring and hear you lecture. It's very interesting. You've been to Sofia more than once.
Yeah, I think it's the third time.
Uh-huh.
And you have met the friends that invited me,
uh-huh.
who were the ones who published, I think, two or three books, included the book on the Tao.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first Slavic country that has an echo on our work in Switzerland.
Yeah.
So Bulgaria seems to be special, and I've heard just at the lunchtime, it's the first Slavic country with a production of the Ring of Wagner.
Yeah.
Did you know?
Yeah. Well, I heard it today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that speaks something special here.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, you feel, I know there's a big conference, the 16-1 conference going on while we're here.
Yes.
Of the Chinese and 16 plus 1, 16 Central and Eastern European countries.
But right.
You know, you feel that you're in the center between Europe and the Eastern world.
Yes.
And you feel like you're on the crossroads.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So we are here to see Wagner's Ring, and we've seen the first two productions. And what I'd like to do is start today and talk a little bit about Wagner, both Das Ring as well as Parsifal. So let's start with the Ring. Tell us about the Ring. Tell us a little bit about Wagner. Who was Wagner?
Well, I mean, he was a world-known great composer who died in 1883 in Venice.
Uh-huh.
He liked Venice, and he was always liking the water. And, you know, he had a very extravagant lifestyle. He was always having wonderful places he lived.
Uh-huh.
But he had a lot of debts, but he found sponsors whenever it was too much. He was, in a way, courageous just to live what he thought he needed. And, and of course, he was a great composer, and he is the only opera composer who wrote his own libretto.
Yeah, yeah.
So the libretto in Wagner is as important as the whole music.
Yeah, it's very serious.
Maybe you get that from reading the English, the text is fantastically important with Wagner.
Yeah.
Actually, he first wrote the libretto, and regularly, and then he composed the music.
Right, and one of the themes is gold.
Yeah.
So.
Well.
You know, the Solari Network world, gold
works,
so.
Yeah. Well, it's as I tried to say, outline in my short lecture, it's the history of gold in relation to human beings. First stage, gold is everywhere. It's in the Rhine. It's a fluid element. It doesn't belong to an individual or to
today. It's just there and it's guarded by the Rhine.
It's guarded and they have no possessiveness. It's there. So that's the first stage. And gold, of course, is related to the sun. As anybody knows who knows a little bit of occult medicine or astrology, it's a sun metal. And you can't own the sun, can you?
No.
So you can't own this gold as a representative of the sun forces in the earth. Phase one, that's the beginning of the Rhine gold. And if you remember the many bars, which is based on three tones, a basic, what is it called in English, a terz, and a quint.
Uh-huh.
It's all playing and building up on this ground threefold melody. And I think that represents a very early stage of humanity in the Atlantean time, where we were in a way not so individualized as later, but
right.
We were close to the spirit, we were close to nature, and we had a certain magical power of the language. This is another aspect.
Right.
Words were related to things. They
more pictorial. They
meant, yes.
Yeah.
And you had a kind of a religious unity feeling with the whole world, and of course with the spirits, with the elementals, with all the higher spirits.
Right.
That phase I consider the best phase of the purity in relation to the gold element, selflessness. It was just there. We were grateful that it was there. There was a break in Human Illusion. And then this, when Alberich comes in Wagner, who represents the human being who wants to get power.
Possess.
Yeah. And you know the...
So he has to possess the gold to rule the world.
And in order to do that, which the Rhine daughters didn't expect, that anyone would do that, he renounces love.
Right.
That is the precondition for...
He can't get the gold and rule the world unless he renounces love.
Right. And he is ready because he is frustrated by not being a lover of these Rhine daughters.
Uh-huh.
And then he renounces love. And from that point of view, from that point in evolution, in the Wagner opera, egotism comes into the gold sphere, symbolized by him making the ring of the ego.
So gold gets turned into something that men can fight over.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Before, it was not there.
Yeah.
And then there is also the curse connected to it that Alberich pronounces in the minute that Wotan, in a very devious way, in a way, takes it from him, and then he curses the gold and whoever possesses it, including Wotan, as you remember.
Uh-huh.
Because Wotan then sacrifices his beloved daughter, Brunhilde, and he renounces love, in a way.
Right.
So you can see this is an infection that goes even into the spiritual realm to a certain degree.
Right.
Yes, and the third stage would be, and this is the end of the Götterdämmerung, that it goes back to the Rhine, which means how could we, if we translate into a development of the human being, how can the human being again have a selfless relation to the higher values in the world, which are material, spiritual, both.
Right.
There's nothing material which has no spiritual background.
Right.
How can we get that? And if you look right at our own world today, we are far away from that.
Right. So I wanted to bring up Parsifal because that's another opera by Wagner, which is very important. And both, to me, both The Ring and Parsifal are about the hero's quest.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for me, Percival is the completion of Siegfried, of the hero that becomes a complete individual, an ego. And Percival is even more advanced in the sense that he has the selflessness, he has the ego power,
mm-hmm.
but he has, as a key, the compassion power. And when he has the compassion for the suffering of Amfortas, which he first doesn't have because he is deaf, by a spiritual intuition, he is working to free Amfortas from his suffering. So the highest stage of the three stages is a selfless selfhood state of the soul, selfless and selfhood at the same time. And if we link it, for me, with the economic reality today, we have not the people who have this moral standard in order to create a new money order and economic
right.
order.
And we're going to talk about that.
Good.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about, in your lecture today, you talked a little bit about the role of the Templars.
Yeah.
Maybe if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, the Templars were very advanced spiritually, and they had a relation, a very individual relation to the Christ impulse, which inspired them to really work socially in a community that no one owned anything, and they all did it for the higher aims of the community. And as you know, and everyone knows who knows the story of the Templars, they were, so to speak, the bankers before the bankers came in a more individual form.
Yeah, they
like
built
the
letter of credit system.
Exactly. They were the credit givers. They were even co-financing the building of the cathedrals.
Right.
Where did that money come from?
Right.
So there were selfless workers with this material wealth they had. They were given, land and money, but no one owned it for himself. And that aroused them.
But they also, the thing I find interesting about the Templars, the Templar was both a spiritual leader, a banker, and a warrior, all in one person.
A lawyer, yeah.
A banker, warrior.
Warrior, yes, exactly.
So one of the reasons they could do the letter of credit system was they could protect the gold.
Yes.
So they had the military power to protect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they were trained to be all three in one person.
Exactly. So they had a kind of a universal educational impulse in them. And so they could move on various levels.
Yeah.
And, of course, the whole history of their persecution is a shame history for the church, for example. But when they survived, I didn't bring that, when they survived, for example, in Scotland, they were behind the fight of Robert Bruce against the English.
Right.
So Scottish independence
came from the Templars.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or with their help, I should say.
With their help.
With their help.
And also they were protected, especially in Portugal. And they were at the root of what became the financing of the great discovery journeys. Columbus, Henry the Seafarer. The Templars were actually preparing the discovery of the world, of the new world. So it's a significant element that we had, that it was crushed. I don't think we have to go to the...
Did I ever tell you my Stone of Destiny story?
Destiny story?
You know what the Stone of Destiny is?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm sitting in my office in 1996.
Have you seen it?
Well, I'm going to tell you how I saw it. So I'm sitting in my office in 1996, and I'm reading the Wall Street Journal, and there's a little quib on the, or just, in the side section on the left, saying that England has given the Stone of Destiny back to Scotland. Well, I fell off my chair at the thought that England would voluntarily give it back. Mm-hmm. But apparently they gave it back on the understanding for any coronation they would send the stone back. So for those of our audience who are listening who don't know what the Stone of Destiny is, you can look it up on Wikipedia, but it is a stone said to be a piece of Jacob's ladder that is placed under the chair of any King of England or King of Scotland during the coronation. Okay, so in 2012, I had a series of very difficult things happen to me all at once, all in the same week. And when it happened, I started to get an irregular heartbeat. And it just didn't go away, it didn't go away. And one thing I knew from people who'd had the same experience is don't go to the doctor. You have to heal it yourself. So in 2015, I was in Edinburgh, and I finished my work early, and so I had enough time to go up to the castle. My hotel was right next to the castle. Mm-hmm. So I ran up to the castle and bought my ticket and headed over to get lunch. I hadn't had lunch yet. And I pulled out the guidebook, and I realized, oh my God, the Stone of Destiny is here. So as soon as I finished lunch, I immediately head to the room where the Stone of Destiny is. I walk in, stand before it, bam, my heart goes right, and I never had another problem.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Magical effect.
It's amazing. All I can tell you is it's an amazing experience to stand in front of the Stone of Destiny. Yeah.
Indeed. Wasn't it connected with Jacob James the First, who was educated in Edinburgh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this Templar's dream is powerful.
Yeah.
And
very powerful.
I was mentioning them because I think they are forerunners of a real brotherly world economy, which is one of the aims of the French Revolution.
Right.
The great ideals, which the globalists do everything to prevent that they are realized.
Right.
It's all phrases, democracy and, all phrases. But there are three ideals deeply in our souls, But if we don't find the corresponding outward spheres for their realization, they will fight each other. You cannot have equality in the spiritual life. You cannot have freedom in the economic life in that sense, because that means just egotism and so on.
Right.
So we need a new social structure.
Well, one of the things I told you that I remember, I was reading Steiner with Anne Watson, who's recorded some of the Steiner pieces for Soleri. And I remember the text saying that Steiner always talks about the Templar's dream. So they're a spiritual phenomena,
yeah,
first and foremost, which is how I think of them.
Yeah.
But then he talks about the fact that before the attack on the Templars, they were pushing the world too fast. The world wasn't ready.
Yeah, in a way, yes.
Yeah, they were pushing
but
too fast.
But maybe in evolution, it's always the case that there's a normal speed. There are things going too quickly, things going too slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, this can all have a good effect.
Right.
So they were, in a way, forerunners. But in a good sense, I think they were forerunners for a world economy and social order that we still haven't realized.
So let's turn to the economic order. And I'm going to focus on some of the points you brought up in your lecture today that I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about growth. I wanted to talk about the balance of selfish versus selfless. And then I wanted to talk about transparency.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the thing about growth. I want to give you an example on growth. So let me see if I can take this. Okay. In the material economy, if you have an oil well, okay, well, let's just pretend this is an oil well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You have an oil well, and I have money. Okay. And I want your oil well, and you want my money. So we trade. Okay. So now I have your oil well and you have my money. How can you be better off?
Having the money.
So now you have the money, I've got the oil well. How can you be better off?
Well, by investing it, by...
You're too honest. If you kill me and take the oil, now you have the money and the oil.
Yes. Okay. Well, yeah, that happens in the opera of Savoy.
Okay, so let's talk about invisible assets. Let's say you have a piece of software and I have money.
Mm-hmm.
And you want my money and I want your software. I give you money and I take your software. But now you still have the software. I have the software. You're better off if I'm alive and trading with you.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference between a concrete asset and something that's not concrete. So what I would tell you is that I think there's nothing wrong with growth, 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 growth. What we need to do is we need to grow human and intellectual capital, not material. So if you look at what's happening environmentally, there's way too much stress on the environment. And what we need to do is shrink our use, you know, lower our footprint, which we can use technology to do.
Yeah.
But we can increase financial wealth and investment wealth by decreasing the use of those resources if you set the economy up right. And so growth can be infinite because there's no such thing as too much
love. Growth is okay, but I mean there's a polarity, a law of polarity. Where there is growth, there must be decay. This is human life. We grow and then we decay. And in economy, I think there is always the anti-growth process, which we don't handle. Then we have crashes, bad crashes, inflation, which is an uncontrolled way of, you know, put something as...
Oh, but I think that's just manipulation.
Maybe it's partly manipulation, yeah. But still, the basic idea in Threefold of Steiner is that the money should relate to the products. And the products, material or immaterial, are never eternal values. They decay also. And the money should just mirror the real economic value creation.
Oh, yeah, right. It should have integrity.
Yeah.
But we have a society where...
And we have no eternal... You know, sorry to add that. If we would have a trust in a higher eternal spiritual life on this planet. I think it would be much less fixed on having material values with pseudo-eternal gross value. We would take it more easy because we would trust if there is an eternal, it's an eternal source of recreation.
Well, but you can't trust the system if it's not trustworthy.
That's true.
So people don't trust the system because it's not trustworthy.
No, but I'm saying it's not only trusting the system that is lacking, but the trusting that there are indestructible values. That is not there in people. They don't trust there is indestructible
values. Oh, I think it is in people.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, no, I think there's a tremendous effort by the people running the economy to destroy it.
Yeah.
And I think they get frustrated because they haven't been able to destroy it yet.
But who is the people who run the economy today? In terms of Wagner, it's the horde of Alberichs.
Well, the people who run things are taking enormous amounts of money secretly out of the economy.
Yes.
And many of these games are because they take that money. So I liken it, in the United States, I liken it to the man who has two families, which is a little bit like Wotan.
In the
ring, he's got two families, and it's causing lots of pain.
Yeah.
And it means a lot of people come to hardship because of the anger of the two families about the other family. So
you
have a leadership, and they're trying to finance two civilizations out of one budget, and to do that they have to lie, and so the question becomes, why? Where's the money going? What's the secret? I call it the space tax. What's the secret space tax about? And, you know, you'll talk to some of them and they'll all say, well, you know, people are happier this way if we keep it all secret. They're happier.
Yeah, but that is, of course, only in the foreground, in the basic, that creates social disruption, revolutions, unrest, because people feel we are treated like, I don't want to say an ugly word.
Yeah.
And that creates what we have now in Europe. It's very visible in America too. People go to the street, they kill without motive, and you have a future of a social situation which is not very bright, I think. If not other people get on the steer of economic decision processes that don't have to lie, I would say these would be the new Templars.
Right.
You know, and that's why I mentioned a man like Dean Dunlop.
Right.
Who has, and we have talked about reincarnation, who comes with a high Templar background and is able to go into organizing international organizations of an economic character which has not his personal ambitional stamp.
Right.
So we need more of these people. I'm sure if we have 12 or 4 times 12 of these individuals on this planet, that would make quite a difference. One is not enough.
Oh, yeah. No, you need thousands.
Or thousands.
You need thousands. You know, but we can all become that if we want. We can all.
Yes.
So one of the things I wanted to bring up, I'm still stuck on growth.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that has helped the economy globally is increases in productivity.
Mm-hmm.
But productivity is stalling for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons I think it's stalling is because of the absence of trust.
Stalling?
Stalling.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's very bad because if you don't keep getting that, you know, I would call it growth.
Yeah.
Then people are going to suffer.
Yes. On the other hand, I think a problem may be connected to it. A one-sided lust for growth in economy is, I think, connected with the mentality, why do you work? Because you need an income. You work for the money you get. But I think a deeper impulse that we should liberate in us is we work because we love to work, because we are here. We come to Earth in order to work, to be productive.
Right.
Today, we work in order to live. We should live in order to work.
Well, not you and me. We,
pardon?
You and I do what we love.
Yes, but we are a rare. I mean, of course, there are some other people.
We're just stubborn.
Yes, we are stubborn, and we are not liked by those who are in the other situation. The ideal would be, and the future economy will have to provide the means, even by new energy.
Yeah.
A new energy which is not centralized,
right,
that you can produce in your own home, so to speak, that will give the possibility to realize our pre-earthly wish,
right,
to go down there to work for this planet, for humanity. Whereas now we are here to work. We work to live. We should live to work.
Yeah, absolutely.
But for that realization, we need another situation, and we need another moral standard. We need to go beyond the Alberich stage of just taking it all personal, wanting to possess things,
right,
that we can't possess. So money must circulate.
Well, part of it is consciousness. What we're saying is this is all driven by consciousness. And if your consciousness is overly focused on the material,
yeah,
you know, you're going to be a little bit like the, I don't know if you've ever seen the dog racetracks where they follow the bunny rabbit around.
Yes, I sure, sure, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's
growth. Do you want a little input on what is, from a spiritual point of view, what the debt means?
Yeah, so, yeah.
You know, there is a lecture by Steiner, it seems to be unrelated to that,
uh-huh,
about the significance of love. And he explains, why is love and love deeds so rare on this planet? It is rare.
Right.
Because it is, first, it has to be free. The forced work is never a work you can do out of love. So love is a very rare thing. Why? Love deeds. Because these deeds are, we have nothing from them. We don't profit personally. And the spiritual explanation, in a way, is when we have a love deed, what we actually do is we paying the debts to the gods who have created us. We give something back to those who have paved the way of all, paved the way for all this evolution.
Uh-huh.
And as we all know, or most people know, from a love deed, I don't profit.
Mm-hmm.
They don't exist. Because we want to have a profit.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting thing. And a pay. So in that sense, we are all debtors to the higher beings.
Right.
So we all give back something there.
Right.
Instead of reducing the debt system to our small work, egotistical world, we should see we are all debtors.
I'm always astonished right now because what you see in America is a liquidation of our legacy.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I wrote an article called William Diefendurfer, The Economic Hitman of Student Loans.
Yeah.
And I talk about how a group on the student loan organization changed the laws and rules so they could make more money from students failing than from students succeeding.
Hmm.
Because they knew the students could never pay back the debt that they were issuing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the economy was changing. So it's called a fraudulent inducement. They got them all in debt that they knew they couldn't pay back, but they changed the rules and the laws so they couldn't file bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And they could make more money charging them late fees and penalties.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could profit from their failure.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wrote in the article, and I said, here's someone, this is one of the members of the board who I knew, here's someone who has been totally blessed by the educational and work opportunities of America, you know, who's been fantastically successful because he was part of this wave in America. So his ancestors blessed him, and instead of him blessing the next generation, he's destroying the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
Intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you liquidate the legacy that you were the beneficiary of?
Hmm.
It's quite extraordinary.
Hmm. Yeah.
And you see it again and again all across America. You see it in housing, you see it in environment, you see it in the student loans, you see it in the pharmaceuticals. Basically, the old are profiting from destroying the legacy that they're supposed to leave to the young.
And what is your answer? Why is this happening? Why are they doing it?
I can only explain it as a spiritual phenomenon. It's demonic.
Yeah, it's demonic.
It's demonic.
Yeah. And to make other people indebted to you, instead of doing free deeds and you pay back your debts to the universe, so
right.
to speak, that requires a spiritual understanding of evolution. And that is why Wagner is so actual, because he has a spiritual understanding of evolution. He doesn't come with a silly theory of it was all the primeval Big Bang, you know. Is it the Big Bang theory?
Right.
It is, you have beings there, and you have beings in evolution. Even Wotan makes an evolution. So we have an evolutionary cosmos with a spiritual core. And unless we take that into account, we won't even be able to solve our material needs and problems without having access to a complementary spiritual understanding.
Right now, so then, after talking about growth, you talked about the balance between selfish and selfless.
Mm-hmm.
And this I want to bring up because I think one of the most important things for the economy, we're watching wealth centralize. So wealth is being centralized, and what was supportive of successful communities and democracy was family wealth, was decentralized wealth, where families really built businesses and built wealth and were the maintainers. And interestingly enough, their wealth was significantly reinvested in communities, including philanthropy, tremendous philanthropy
uh-huh.
that comes out of family wealth.
Uh-huh.
And this idea of, wealth isn't good, is being used to justify the centralization. Families don't need wealth,
mm-hmm.
and they shouldn't
mm-hmm.
be selfish,
mm-hmm.
and they shouldn't mm-hmm. be, you know, mm-hmm. blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah. It's all the sort of
yeah.
talk that's used to centralize. And, of course, debt is a very important tool to centralize.
Who?
Debt.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so, to me, it's absolutely essential that we decentralize wealth back, and that means family wealth needs to go up.
Yeah, yeah.
And part of the challenge of any family right now is they're trying to protect their wealth, and the number of people basically trying to steal it or trick it or drain
mm-hmm.
it
mm-hmm.
is extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're the head of a family and you're responsible to build and maintain the family resources, it's war. It's incredible. You know,
mm-hmm.
I just finished being an investment advisor for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I really got to live.
You finished with that.
Yeah. So I close it down on September 1st. But, you know, so I'm in the process of closing it down now. But, you know, it's like being on the front line of a horrible war.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the number of ways that the system is trying to steal or trick or cheat people out of their money, it's frightening.
Yeah.
So one of the things, as you said, some of the comments about we need to be selfless is always used by the centralizers to justify why families shouldn't have wealth. Which is opposite of what I believe.
They justify their own selfishness,
which is
endlessly growing.
Exactly.
That's phrases. That's not reality.
Well, but they're very clever about using two things. One is selflessness. They're very clever about using that as an argument to steal from the families.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing they're very good at is growth. Growth is bad.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't have a growing business.
No, of course not. That's not something what I'm saying.
Right.
But if there is a certain growth, you have also to have people who are able to lend or even to donate. And to donate, you need trust and you need courage. And this is lacking today. Free sponsoring without, we have the three kinds of money in
mm-hmm.
Steiner. Buy money, lend money, and and donation model.
You know, it's so funny in America because crowdfunding has really taken off. There's been so much effort to prevent local and community investment or to make it expensive and difficult. And so now people have just said, you know, we don't care. We're just going to give each other money. So now they're circulating a ton of money and they're just doing it as gifts, and so no one can stop it.
Mm-hmm.
We're hoping it delivers this month. Mm-hmm. We raised $36,000 to buy Dr. Farrell, Joseph Farrell, a pipe organ.
Hmm.
In fact, I have a picture of it if you want to see it. It's it's so beautiful.
So you undermine the official Bard system by doing these things. That's great.
It is great. It's, you know, and
an example.
We have wonderful, wonderful subscribers.
Get initiative. Yeah.
I remember one who, we did three phases to raise the money. And at the beginning of each phase, somebody was a major donor that put up a match. And on the second phase, somebody wrote me and said, you know, I want to put up the match donation for the second phase. And I said, okay, well, I'll announce it and we'll raise the money. And as soon as I have the money, I'll tell you to send it. He said, no, I'd much rather send it to you guys. I trust it much more in your hands than it sitting in the securities account.
Wonderful.
But that's, you know, that's the...
These are small entities, homeopathic doses of a better handling these affairs.
Wait a minute, let me see. Why is this behaving so badly? Wait a minute. It's quite beautiful. I'm very excited because it's a year late. It took an extra year to build it.
Wonderful.
Let me...
And where is he playing his organ?
Oh, it's going to be at his house. It's a digital pipe organ, so the pipes are digital.
Uh-huh.
And I'm very excited. There we go.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that beautiful?
It's all digital.
The pipes are digital. The console is it's a full organ console.
Hardware.
But then the pipes, you have two computers, or like two laptops. And what's amazing is you can get software that is all the different greatest organs of the world. Hmm. You can, you know, you can be the Harlem pipes today, and you can be the... You know, Shark
Notre
tomorrow,
Dame, right? Shark
Notre
Dame. Tomorrow,
So here it is. It's all there. Anyway, so it's still being built, but but so what I'm saying is, you know, people have come to the point where they're so in tune with real value that they would rather circulate donations to each other than be bothered with the whole corrupt system.
Mm-hmm. But that's a healthy.
That's very healthy.
And this is happening in your Tennessee community or all over it?
It's all over.
All over.
It's all over.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's much harder to do in a place. You know, I go back to my quote from our last interview that I keep quoting to you.
Mm-hmm.
We have to find each other through the tunnels of loneliness. And what you find when you do one of these things is it's people from all over.
Yeah.
It's like your subscribers or my subscribers.
The shuttle suddenly pop up. Yes.
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to bring up, and I keep talking about this, is transparency. Because I think a lot of the corruption in the economy hides behind secrecy. You know, it can only thrive if there's secrecy, particularly if there's secrecy about the money. There's terrible secrecy in the United States. And they seem to be able to continue to do it.
Are there other people? Are you actually the one who has discovered the story of these 30 trillion unaccounted money?
Well, I first, actually it was my lawyer who discovered in 1998, we were reading the HUD documents and realized that there was 59 billion of undocumentable, which is impossible. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's impossible that HUD couldn't balance its books at that point. And we tried to tell people about it, and then we discovered more at the Department of Defense. And coming into 9/11, the number was $4 trillion. And there was no doubt that I was the leader of teaching people about that. And I was working with reporters who were writing stories about the missing money. And in fact, we were about to break a huge story on September, it was that Friday, 16th or 17th, and Rumsfeld that Monday came out with his press conference saying that there was 2.1 missing. Actually, there was 3.3 missing at that point. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he said 2.1 for just 1 year. And I remember calling the reporter whose story it was that was going to publish on the 16th or the 17th and saying, you know, nothing could stop this story from going mainstream now. Then 9/11 happened, as you know, which was a very significant effort not only to cover up all the money that had disappeared, but it really helped move what I call the black budget on budget and allowed for much greater control of cash flows and much more secret money. So I know because you have written a lot about 9/11 and you're very knowledgeable about 9/11, so I know you know this.
Anyway, well, the put option and the thing, the speculation there on...
Right.
That was a phenomenon.
Right. The money issues on 9/11. 9/11 was a very profitable operation. Anyway, so I kept talking about the missing money because more and more went missing. We had a lot of money go missing in Iraq. But other people, Thomas, would jump in and write about it. You know, and 9/11, the 9/11 Truth Group started to realize that the missing money was an important part of that. You know, the office that was destroyed at ONI at the Pentagon had been doing a serious investigation. And a lot of the documents, investigative documents related to related securities fraud, were destroyed. And a lot of people read and focused, but they would kind of go in and out. And I kept beating the drum. And what was interesting to me was how many people kept saying to me, well, you know, that's your issue. We have a different issue. And I kept saying, don't you understand, if a group of people can steal, you know, at that time it was $8 or $12 trillion, then they get to control everything. And they get to decide what happens. So we're talking about a coup d'etat. We're talking about, you know, controlling the governance system secretly. Mm-hmm. But people just couldn't relate to it emotionally.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then in 2015... something happened, which I describe as a cut and run. So you had $6.5 trillion disappear or of undocumentable adjustments at DOD and a couple hundred million at HUD. And I call it a cut and run. It's like they stole everything left. You know, it was just. And then the company that was running the payment systems at DOD spun their division out to another, to a new company, and I think to get the liability off their books. Anyway, so I kept talking about the fact that in 1 year, 6.5 trillion of undocumentable adjustments at DOD, and people literally didn't, you know, didn't believe me, even though I was using government documents. Mm-hmm. And that's when Dr. Skidmore called me and said, because he heard me on a radio show, and he thought, you know, she has to be wrong. You know, she has to be making a mistake. So he went and got the documents. I had the documents up on my website just for that year. And he realized, oh, no, she's right. Anyway, so that's when he said, would you, I have some graduate students. How about if I go do a very thorough check? So he and his graduate students went through 20 years at DOD and HUD. And we were able to put all the documents up on our website. And it was amazing because, and it was funny because I said to him, he wrote a very good report about it. And I said, I don't want to publish your report until I have all of the documents on my server and we're linking to my server instead of the government servers. Mm-hmm. And he thought I was a little paranoid. Hmm. So we put it all up, we publish his report, and they take the documents down.
So you were not that wrong. Huh?
No.
With that cautious measure.
But there was something about this time around, you know, and then I published a big study on the pension funds. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yeah,
but basically briefly. What I was able to say is, look, here are your pension funds. Here's the U.S. government. Your pension funds have real money. They buy $5 trillion of treasuries, and then that money disappears out the back door into private hands. And you get back an IOU, a treasury security, which you are liable for as taxpayers. So you've traded $5 trillion of a real asset for $5 trillion of a debt. You know, the U.S. government is just a laundry to steal your money.
Yeah.
So that's but when I started to realize.
Well, how can you introduce transparency? I think there are a number of obstacles. Naivete, gullibility, not seeing the reality of fraudulent manipulations today. And the second is a lack of trust. People don't want to trust each other anymore. They want to control. How to build up trust and how to decrease the monumental amount of naivety and gullibility, if that is the right word.
Well, the reason I've kept up for 20 years is I knew the day would come when they say, you know something, we're going to have to cut your pensions because there's not enough money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I wanted to be able to say, well, wait a minute, what about this $21 trillion? Let's just get that.
Yep. Yep.
Don't tell me there's not enough money. There's $21 trillion right there. Let's go get it, you know. And don't tell us, you know, that you're going to cut our pension funds, because what I want to know is where's my $21 trillion. Let's use that to fund the pension funds. So this was never for me about the missing money. It was about the pension funds. Because that's what they were stealing. They were stealing the pension money. So I've kept at it, because when that day finally came that the people who were hearing, oh, well, we're going to have to cut your pension fund, I wanted them to be able to remember, oh, wait a minute, there is money there. So that's my hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You did a good job in that.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if it works.
Mm-hmm. You had something else in mind? I think I was wondering also the question you sent me from one of your subscribers for this interview. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that for this interview?
Yeah.
Well, it must not be, but I remember dimly. What was the question?
Let me get the question.
And you have some other points, maybe?
Yep.
Yeah, good. Hmm.
So you had said, listen for the deeper purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
In a complex situation, listen for the deeper purpose. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, we spoke a lot about egohood, personality. If the personality is hermetically closed against anything higher, namely, you could call it your higher self or so on, you cannot listen to what would come if you would be open to a higher sphere.
Right.
That is what I meant. We have to learn maybe to, you know, the problem with egotism is not that we don't need it, but that it gets so close that many people think that's my holy ego. But it's just a reflection, a product of the higher self, which is far higher, and which is in community with other higher selves and with the spiritual beings and so on. We have to be open to the inspiration of our own higher self. We could call it also the angel.
Right.
It's not exactly the angel, but it's in the direction. But how can you do that if you are closed in yourself too much?
Well, you know, one of the things I always require is to try and look at a situation that's happening spiritually. Why is this happening?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the disciplines I try and go through whenever anything that appears to me instantly to be bad is happening, I say to myself, pretend this is a movie and that what's happening right now turns out to be the best thing that ever happened to you. Okay, now write the script. And what I discover is a lot of times, and this is particularly in a period of high change, you know, something can happen to you that turns out to be wonderful for you,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't feel wonderful at first.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you when you look at things spiritually, you realize, oh.
Right. But that implies what you're saying for me. You look at things from a outside point of view objectively. You don't identify with every detail and lose yourself in it, but you take a stance which is a bit outside or above, if you like, and then you come to these other inclinations and feelings.
Right. So the second question is, what is interdimensional awareness?
Is that a word that I used or you used?
I think it was, they were asking because they heard it somehow.
I'm sure you said that.
I did it?
Well, I don't know. Interdimensional, I wouldn't know. I could link to the first question, but this...
Well, to me, there is intelligence in other dimensions other than the material. We're in a material dimension. There are intelligences in other dimensions, and we interact with
them. I totally agree. You could even say, to make a grotesque example, demons are intelligent. And demons can possess a stupid person. And the person is not intelligent, but the demon is intelligent.
Right.
And the person can be even stupid. By the way, we have a beautiful example in Wagner's Ring. You remember the scene where Alberich is getting, proud, and they trick him into showing what he can do. And at that moment, you can see...
Is this in Das Rheingold?
In the Rheingold.
Yeah.
And you could see at that point, now he gets stupid.
Right.
Because the intelligence who makes use of him to get something away from him is higher. And he gets stupid.
Yeah.
So... to have only personal interests and power at the same time makes the individual more stupid. But that doesn't mean that quite a number of clever demonic beings can come in.
Right. And what I see...
Look at Bush, for example. Bush first, I always thought, as an individual, he's just stupid. He's uneducated. But he acts in a way that you can say, what intelligence is acting through him, not out of him, through him.
Right.
So again, we come to the necessity of have a spiritual dimension of social phenomena, which not ordinary psychology or sociology can ever explain, but we need a concrete demonology. By the way, in one of the essays only published 10 years ago by Emerson, they found essay script fragments, which were never published. One chapter is demonology.
Really?
Yes. You're Emerson.
Is it available?
It is.
I can
give you the title.
It's have to
wonderful.
Read that.
It's short and it's like wit and humor, demonology, genius, and Emerson is so inspiring, and he was convinced we need a sober science of demonology.
Right.
And I think today we need that more than ever.
Well, it's interesting because I think it's very important to organize your life so that you attract the light and keep the demons basically far away.
Yeah.
And it always shocks me how many people I know who freely open themselves and let in the demons, and they don't understand how dangerous it is.
Yeah. Well, they don't realize their reality.
It's real, right? It's real.
They don't take it seriously. You know that the church and the Jesuits are far better in that.
Right.
If you read the exercises of Ignatius of Loyola, you could see there is a certain demonology. They knew that they were demonic beings, those who trade themselves. So they take that seriously. But at the same time, they try to make people not believe in these things, and then they are manipulable.
Right.
You can manipulate them. So spiritual knowledge has to be spread in order to be fit for all these dangers.
Well, to me, culture, part of culture is creating the power you need to manage that interaction with the interdimensional so that you keep away the demonic and you attract in the light.
Mm-hmm. I could even think we can go further and say we keep them away not to be influenced, but we also have maybe the possibility to transform them. For example, there is a lecture again by Steiner about when we lie, we create demonic beings. We create them.
Right.
So as we create them, we have the task to metamorph, to transform them.
Right.
And he doesn't give specifically the answer. I always ask me, what is a transformation of a liar being? And, you know, I didn't come further than thinking, maybe this has to do something with fancy and imagination. Take the fact that good liars, if there are good liars, have a lot of imagination.
Right.
But if the imagination is not related to real things in the world, but maybe to art, poetry, then it's a good thing.
Right.
So maybe we should also have the aspect not to keep things out, because that's a bit what at the time of Christ the Essenes did. They kept things out. And when the Christ was going to the Essenes, he could see they are protected from the demons. They could keep them out, but what would the demons do? They were all the more attacking the rest of the population.
Right.
So that's only one step, to keep them out, and the next step would be to transform them, even to help beings. But that's, of course, a huge subject.
Right.
That's Manichaeism, if you like, to transform evil into a higher good. But we are at the beginning of all this process.
So today in your lecture, you talked about accessing the divine intelligence.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you said?
Yeah.
What did you say?
Access to divine intelligence. Well, is struggle to be open for inspirations that, you know, it's not coming from your own or from our own little personality, but there is a source that inspires something. And this was common in ancient cultures, in Egypt, in Greece, it was the muse, you know. And today, I think many people are inspired, but they don't know what inspiration is. So they are inspired by demonic beings, by bad beings, because they have no cue to understand. We need to have the wish to understand who is inspiring. And then it can be a god or it can be a devil.
Right.
And with the higher intelligence I was speaking about was, of course, a positive higher one. But how can you be sure if you don't try to find out? You can have an inspiration from a being that is actually not a very good one, but it speaks nicely to you. So
right.
You think, oh, that must be an angel. It's not.
It's not.
We have to pierce appearances, even with spiritual experience. We have to go to the core of it. As long as we cling to appearances, we can be deceived.
Right.
The devil works with deceit, you know, to make us believe A, but it is not A, it's Z, or it's B, or it's P. So spiritual discernment is what we need. And then we can maybe take Husserl, the father of Zionism. He had an inspiration in Paris, Whitsun, 1895. And he was really stormed by ideas. And he was going, you know, Husserl was almost getting crazy, he said. Either I'm getting mad or I'm being one of the great benefactors of mankind. And in order to support the storm of inspirations he had, and I wonder what kind of inspirations was that? Zionism. You know what he did? He went into a Wagner's opera every evening when it was played in Paris. Into Wagner. Herzl. And in Israel you couldn't play Wagner for, I think, until now. Because Wagner is rated as anti-Semite and so by some people.
Yeah.
So Herzl is a good example for someone who had inspiration without having a concept that there are inspirations and that we have to find out from what source do they come. His inspiration was not very lofty because...
So I'm reading Henry Adams now.
Yeah,
you inspired me to do it because I'm on my way to Chartres.
Great.
And I've been watching documentaries about the buildings of the great cathedrals. And one of the things I read, Adams published this book in 1904. And one of the things he said was that Chartres, as of that date, I don't know about now, but as of that date, had never needed to be fixed or buttressed. Mm-hmm. It had stood for all these centuries, and it is never needed. I mean, it's an architectural feat, the likes of which...
It comes from the time where we have spoken about, in context of the temples, there were people, anonymous, we don't know the names. We don't know the names of the sculpture of these wonderful things.
Right.
But there is a strength in that. They knew what they were doing. And that's one of the key, I think, answers. Why does this endure? There was no personal ambition, I'm the greatest architect, or this or that, but it still is there.
Well, but it was also the desire to do something absolutely excellent.
Absolutely?
Excellent.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Together.
Together?
It took enormous teamwork.
Yeah, I mean, and all these people, even the humble workers or the bakers, if you look at Chartres at that time, it was a community. The whole community was centered by looking up to this huge goal. We build a cathedral, which is a bridge to the higher realities in the world, so to speak. We all do that. So we know why we are working. There is a sense in that. And where are the communities like that today?
Well, it's interesting. I was in Dublin in 2016 and I went to see the Book of Kells.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, oh, these monks were writing this so that it would be good for 1,000 years.
Exactly.
You know?
And they didn't care whether anybody knew their names or their identities.
Right.
So this is a strength source that you know, Dean Dunlop, I've talked about as a great reborn Templar in modern economy. He wrote articles and he had a friend and he said to his friend, whatever you like, what I write, treat it as your own, quote it, and you don't need to give a credit where it comes from. So this is the mentality of we don't have to stress our personal source for this or that, but we have to fix on finding the truth in things, and so we're not getting competitive, we're even sharing.
Well, it's interesting, I've said this before in the Solari Report, I grew up in a family where on both sides of my family they were very competitive, but the competition was about who could make the most important lasting contribution to mankind. So my father's father introduced penicillin to Tennessee. I had an uncle who started the first transplant center in South Carolina. My father, when he came back from World War II, he'd been working in a MASH institute, and he realized that the emergency rooms in America weren't done properly. So he redesigned emergency rooms for the whole country, and it saved thousands of lives. You know, so if you came home and said, well, I made a lot of money, everybody would look at you like, get out of here.
That's,
you know, that was for...
Did you do anything for humanity? Did you?
You know, they were very... It was kind of like real men change the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They don't make money. Yeah, you know, what's your problem?
Yeah. And changing the world, I think, if I may hint to Henry Adams, what I understand and I like very much as far as I understand, he written a book called The Education of Henry Adams. So he was convinced the changing of the world starts with the self-education of an adult.
Right.
And this is a key moment. And I'm very happy, I have to tell you as an American, as a European, that you have such a man out of the president line of the Adams who has a deep relation to Europe, to spiritual values. In this book you find things that are so amazing.
Yeah, and he was very, very transcendent.
He was transcendent.
Mm-hmm.
He was spiritual. I don't know whether he ever thought of reincarnations, but we as readers with that thought can ask when he... There is a hymn, a wonderful hymn of the Virgin Mary, where he said, 700 years ago, when I was praying in front of the Virgin and was sitting or kneeling in front of Abelard, who was one of the great teachers at that time, then you can ask yourself the question, are these his backgrounds? And I would say, yes. So this is an interesting phenomenon that you have this American who feels so home in this time. And
right.
It is wonderful. And
so here's the question, where did the technology come from to build...
The what?
Where did the technology come from to build the great cathedrals? We don't know.
I don't know the details. I only know a little bit the history. And if you are in France, the first cathedral, the beginnings are connected to Saint-Denis, near, and they had an abbot who was called Sugerius. And he started to transform the Romanic into a Gothic part of the church. But how they were able to do this, it's hard to say for me. I can't say.
I don't know.
But maybe
it's another great mystery.
If you have a great ideal, and also an ideal connected to spirituality, I guess that your faculties grow by that. You can do things that otherwise you couldn't.
Right. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway. So I have to bring this up. You're going to China.
Yes.
Yeah, this is exciting.
Maybe we have to talk after your experience in Chartres. I'm very thrilled that you go to Chartres. And we can, yeah.
Well, I'll see you when I get to Switzerland.
Excellent.
But I'll go to Chartres after that.
Doesn't matter. I can give you a few points maybe if you're interested. And what about China? We should talk about China afterwards.
So you're going to China for the first time.
First time.
In September.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm very excited to hear
three cities. Chongqing, my pronunciation.
You're going to Hong Kong, and then you're going to the Pearl River Delta, somewhere in Canton.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you go to Beijing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm, of course, very thrilled because I know that the Steiner movement is growing fast, and I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
60 schools, hundreds of...
Oh, wow.
60 schools, hundreds of kindergarten. In China. And I'm going to meet the man who is the head of a teacher's seminar in Beijing. So I wonder how this is. This is, of course, an interesting point for me.
Yeah.
And, of course, I try to see whether it's possible to link to the Tao. But I'm sure it's not easy. I will not press it. Because the communism has covered it all up, all these deep roots. So I'm not naively thinking, oh, they will be happy to hear about the Tao by a Swiss man. Probably they don't want to hear it at all. So it will be quite an interesting adventure.
Yeah. Well, our second quarter wrap up, the theme is the rise of the Asian consumer. So
okay.
I've been studying what the impact is globally of this phenomenal, you know, the between India and China, you're going to have 800 million people in the middle class in Asia. 800 million.
Okay.
I mean, it's huge numbers.
Yeah.
And their per capita income is converging with ours. So it's going to be quite a significant phenomenon for decades to come.
Yeah.
So we'll see what you say. Okay.
Thank you.
Before we close, anything else you want to add? There's only one thing I want to add. I want to thank you for inspiring me to come to Sofia and the opportunity to see the ring with you.
Then I thank you for coming and having the opportunity to meet our little circle.
They're wonderful people.
Which I think is quite...
You have people from Germany, Switzerland,
Denmark,
Bulgaria, Switzerland.
And we have a few more from England.
Yeah, England.
And,
yeah.
But they're not here. Terry Waldman, for example, will come to Switzerland.
And the people attending, apparently it's Wagner societies from all over the world, are sending people here.
The people who are attending what?
The opera.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, Wagner societies from all over the world.
International.
Yeah.
And I must really say, I have to think about that. I was really surprised by the communication that this is the first Slavic country which produces Wagner, the Ring.
Yeah.
So that says, and you know,
in
the history of Bulgaria...
We're moving beyond World War II.
You had, yes, we're moving beyond World War II.
Yeah.
And you had a deep spiritual background in the Bulgarian past. I don't know the names of the movements anymore. And you had great spiritual people. Peter Danov, for example, was one here. And a Bulgarian person came to Steiner in Munich and said, could you give me hints for a meditation and this and that? And he said, well, you have Mr. Danov in Bulgaria. And I read a biography. He was in America. He is quite an extraordinary man. Peter Danov. is connected with this country. Mm-hmm. And tomorrow we have a little chat in the Vienna Cafe, and I know there will be ton of people there.
Right.
They are convinced he is even bigger than Steiner or Christ, I don't know. But he is noteworthy. He is.
Right.
So you have a spiritual backbone in this country. And maybe that has to do with the openness for something like Wagner.
I forgot to ask you, I want to ask you, the present age, what's coming up for the next 6 months in the present age? What do you have percolating?
I'm afraid to say it's a shame. We don't plan. we have ideas, perspectives.
Uh-huh.
I will bring something on Wagner, certainly. And we have... we bring a book in English translation on sexualism.
Uh-huh.
A time question, a time disease, like the gender nonsense and all that. Sorry to say it like that.
Yeah.
All these confusions, am I a man or woman and so on. The book is called Sexualism. It's a time disease and it's, what is it? Cure. It's curing process. So that's an actual subject today.
I don't know if you've looked at artificial intelligence and transhumanism.
Yeah.
But essentially, I just finished reading a new book on AI, and what it said was, and it's extraordinary in its ignorance, but what it says is, you know, we've now gotten to the point where we can recreate, re-engineer, and completely alter our software. Mm-hmm. You know, they talk about people as though they're machines.
Yeah.
And but we're going into a phase, and this is transhumanism, where we can reinvent and alter our hardware. So they absolutely believe that you can just, you know, that the human is a machine, and you can manipulate and change the software, and you can manipulate and change the hardware.
Well, it's transmaterialism, you could call it. It's transhumanism. It's a euphemism. It's a lie word. It's nothing to do with humanism. In fact, it is a hyper-materialistic.
Well, what you're doing is you're changing humans and making them into a natural resource that can be exploited.
They lose their human core. They lose sometimes, you can lose your soul or your ego, and then you can ask who is coming in.
Right.
But that's going on, of course.
Right. It's basically insane.
It's insane.
Yeah.
And it's pushing humans out of this planet as coming down, as I said before, this is a deep conviction. We all come down with an individual, smaller or bigger mission to perform.
Right.
We come down to work. And now we are driven away by all these things, also food, drugs, what is it called in the childhood already, in injection, vaccination,
or, right.
You know these things. So we need a human future culture, not a transhuman caricature of this.
Right, right. But a longer discussion for another day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Thomas. Have a wonderful, wonderful evening.
You too.